Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello and welcome to The Shift, the podcast that aims to tell the no-holds-barred truth about being a woman post 40, created and hosted by me, journalist and author Sam Baker. This week, I'm nosing around the central London flat of the multi-zillion selling novelist and screenwriter Jojo Moyes.
I feel like I'm not an imposter anymore. I feel like the body of work has given me a right to be there, but it's taken me 10 years minimum to feel like
that.
If you
had imposter syndrome, there would be no hope for any of us. The author of smash hits, including the much-loved global phenomenon Me Before You, and her latest, the wonderful, evocative Giver of Stars, Jojo became stratospherically Hollywood-level visible at exactly the point when the world expects women to go and play nicely somewhere nobody has to look at them. In the next 45 minutes, she'll talk about how that felt, as well as looking better at 50 than 40, finally shedding lifelong imposter syndrome, and why making new friends at 50 is the best thing ever. I'm here in Jojo Moyes' flat, several floors above a noisy central London street. It's clean, modern, tidy, swanky. Hi, Jojo.
Hi. Just interested to see my flat through somebody else's eyes.
Well, it's actually not as swanky as last time I was here, but it looks a bit more lived in.
Yeah, that's because I'm here a couple of days a week and my clutter does spread. So
we were just talking a bit about how our lives have changed in the last 10 years. I think it's probably 10 years, isn't it, since we got really friendly. And I really distinctly remember I had just left Red and you had just written Me Before You and we went out for lunch. That was when you had just found out Me Before You was Rich and Judy. Do you remember?
I remember a different meeting and we went for a quiet early evening drink with a bunch of other women on Twitter. And all I can remember is that about 2 o'clock, the now editor of The Guardian was ringing my husband saying, Jojo is very busy doing busy work and won't be home tonight. And I ended up crashing on your sofa and I'd never met you before. And then sort of had to do a kind of walk of shame of sorts through central London the following morning, having got completely pie-eyed with this group of very excellent, very rowdy women who clearly didn't stop at one drink.
Well, let's talk a bit first about how your life has, well, for want of a better way of putting it, shifted. Mm. In the last 10 years, the last 10 years have taken you from 40 to 50.
Yeah, and the change in my life has been absolutely beyond any idea I could have had about it. At 40, I had 8 books behind me, none of which had been a bestseller. I was struggling. I was worried about money all the time. I think in most relationships you have a worrier and a non-worrier, and I was very definitely the worrier. 3 kids to get through school and college. And as you know, I wrote a book called Me Before You almost on spec because my existing publisher wasn't very keen on the idea. And that changed my life in about 8 million ways. I mean, it didn't just bring me the success I don't even want to say hoped because it took me so far beyond what I'd hoped for.
It's such a crazy level of success.
Yeah, really, it went crazy. And so I didn't just exceed all my expectations work-wise, but I think it profoundly changed my character as well. And it has continued to change. I've become far less catastrophist. I was very much a catastrophist. I was always braced for the next problem and trying to work out solutions to things before they'd even happened. I was that worrier. And I worry a lot less now, although obviously I worry about the other things like people I love getting ill. But it also made me reassess how I was in the eyes of everybody else, because the one thing that success brings you is greater visibility. And at a time in your 40s when you might not really be used to being very visible, because in traditional terms, that's the age at which you start to become invisible, or so society would have it. So I've had to learn to be a slightly more public person with all the issues that that brings with it. I've had to learn to navigate success, which is lovely in many respects and quite complicated in others. I mean, it has an impact on everybody around you. It's not just you. And I've had to learn how to handle a lot of it. You know, it requires some diplomacy. It requires social skills that I didn't have before. Also, you have to also think about what your responsibilities are. You know, for example, philanthropically, you have to decide what kind of person you're going to be in handling this. And all this time I've been bringing up, you know, teenage children as well. So there's a lot. There was a lot. Would I change it? No. God, how lucky have I been? I mean, it's, you know, there is not a day still 10 years on that I don't wake up feeling just like something amazing happened, and I'm incredibly lucky.
It's really interesting from outside because you have changed a lot from where I sit, which is not someone who's known you 40 years, but someone who's known you quite well, maybe 10 or 12.
Yeah.
But in a way you haven't. You're a bit more like, you're like a kind of distilled version of you. Let's talk about the visibility invisibility thing. How did that manifest itself? I think that's really interesting.
Well, for a start, people have an opinion on your work. And then with the film, people started to have an opinion on me. And
just that Hollywood thing.
Yeah, because everyone said to me at MGM before the film came out, you have no idea how much impact film has compared to books. And I thought, yeah, all right, just because you're in film, you don't know. Oh, my God. I mean, you know, just from the mere promotional side of it, you know, you do kind of 3 weeks traveling the world with your stars, which is
doing the whole junket thing. Which is how,
and that's kind of sobering because suddenly you're this kind of doughy-faced nan in between two of the most beautiful people on earth.
So you were traveling with
Emilia Clarke, Sam Claflin, you know, whoever. I mean, yeah, literally the most beautiful people you can imagine, and sparky and in their 20s and gorgeous. And then, you know, there was one kind of hilarious thing where Emilia gets papped all the time, and at airports it became a kind of running joke, except I hated it. Turns out I just felt really, I don't like that thing of paparazzi, well, who does, but I really felt very unsettled by the fact that you could be somewhere and then 2 minutes later a bank of cameras arrive out of nowhere. And I remember in a certain newspaper, as I was doing this, my husband just killing himself laughing because Emilia, who has adapted and is wonderful at all these things, just sailed through smiling with her sunglasses on and perfect makeup. And you can just see me behind her clutching my laptop like a weapon and scowling at everybody because I can't do it. I have no poker face. I can't hide how I feel. So that was a bit weird because, A, you're confronted with your own image a lot more, and so you're also confronted with the signs of your own mortality. Thank God for hair and makeup. Yeah, also people are going to start behaving as if they know truths about you. And the hardest thing is when those truths are not true. And on social media, there's no point trying to answer them back. You know, that creates its own momentum. And then before you know it, you've got editors of broadsheets saying, well, perhaps you'd like to kind of answer this in... And, you know, and then it becomes a thing and you're like, this was not
it's
a thing.
Not true. Yeah. It wasn't true in the first place.
Exactly. Yeah. So why would I want to give it oxygen? And that's happened to me a couple of times, and it's really fucking hard, actually, to keep your mouth shut when you're quite a straightforward person who just wants to say, this isn't true. And I can't imagine what it's like if it happens to you in your 20s, and also with all the visibility that comes with being a kind of young and, you know, maybe you're an actress or a music star. I mean, promotional stuff is hard anyway. It's hard to give the right amount of stuff, give the right answers, make sure everybody's happy, be on 18 hours a day. I have a friend who says that writing stuff, writing films is the easy bit. What you get paid for is the promotion. And I think that's kind of an interesting way of looking at it, because to me, promotion is much, much harder than writing books or films.
Well, it's two completely different skills,
yeah,
isn't it? Effectively sitting in a room, I mean, films are a bit different because they're a bit more collaborative, but sitting in a room 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, writing a story, yeah, which is what you did with Me Before You, yeah, versus spending 3 weeks on a red carpet. I mean, those things could not be more different. How did you find the confidence to do that? What did you have, external tools?
Oh, gosh, confidence. I'm one of these people who, if I'm told I have a job to do, I'll just do it. And I don't really think about it. I don't process it till afterwards. And I think because I had no idea of the level of the whirlwind that you get sucked into, I probably didn't even think about it. I just do what I'm told, to some extent. I'm not confident in a way that I think, oh, God, I look fantastic, or I can, you know, project myself wonderfully. But what I do believe, I've always believed that I can pretty much do anything I set my mind to if I work hard enough. I've got a real kind of Protestant work ethic that comes from that. So I just apply that to whatever I'm told to do. So I will do the job and I'll turn up and I'll smile and I'll try and give the right answers. But it is an art, and I'm not sure I always got it right. I know I didn't always get it right. There's also a joy in it, which is that being part of a film is a huge, huge deal. It's diplomatically tricky. If you're the writer, you have to learn to navigate a film set and the various levels of production and studio input. And luckily, I had some really good people helping me, because I think it would be very easy as a writer to go wrong in that world, because there is a clear hierarchy. And if you don't understand that hierarchy, you're going to put your foot in it. And because I had people who'd been there before me who could talk to me about it, I was able to learn their lessons. There was a joy in learning a new thing as well. And also, I love writing books. I write books because I love writing books, but none of us are going to pretend that the great kind of dream isn't to have a lovely film made of your book as well. I'd done all the hard work, and this was the bit that was allegedly the kind of payoff, which was, you know, getting to see nice readers and nice fans and people getting excited about it and crying in movie theatres and all the rest of it. I'd be a liar if I said that wasn't fun as well.
And all the blokes who nipped off to the loo to cry at the screening, because they didn't want to cry in public.
I love that, yeah. And there was a period where people were just sending me pictures of them lying in cinema corridors crying, and that just made me laugh so much. It was just brilliant. And, you know, when it works, when people are happy with what you've done, there's no better feeling, because it has a huge reach. It's, you know, it is kind of magical. If I had a phrase for my 40s to 50s, it would be all the things, all the time. Basically, I literally live four seasons in one day, every single day.
And so that can only get better, even more seasons in one day between 50s and 60s.
Here's an interesting thing. It's coming up to 50, it's hard if you're a woman. Perhaps it's hard for men as well, but I definitely felt it.
I really agree.
Yeah, it's the run up to it was almost worse than the doing of it. And I had a lot of stuff going on in my personal life as well. But there is something terrifying about the idea that you are 50 to me. I just associated it with bank managers and all the rest of it. You know, it was like grown
but
up.
Men, not women.
Yes, yeah, maybe. But I've done a few things in the last few years. One is that I've lost some weight. I've got a lot fitter. I've actually started to put a lot more effort into taking care of myself, which I was always quite bad at, like a lot of English women. And I think maybe some of that is to do with spending time in Hollywood, where it's not considered kind of particularly indulgent to take care of yourself. And so I think because I came of age in the 90s, when it was almost unfashionable to be too dollied up. You know, you wore your jeans and your boots and your vest top and your messy hair, and you might have a bit of eyeliner and lipstick, but you wouldn't dream of doing much more than that, because
it was a bit try hard.
And now I do. I run a few times a week. I have a personal trainer. I spend a lot of money on skincare, and I do all those things, and I get my hair done, and I just pay a lot more attention. And it's a bit distressing how many people tell me I look so much better, but I'm fitter and I look better than I did at 40. And that's sort of quite a nice thing, if I'm honest, because I do think I look better, and I dress better, I understand myself better. So, and also when the success thing first hit, I had girlfriends not just girlfriends, actually, male friends as well, who told me for about 3 or 4 years, I looked permanently like a rabbit trapped in headlights. I felt for a while like somebody was always asking me for something, always. And there was a stage where I was trying to respond personally to every email because a lot of them were very moving and personal. And it's just too much in the end. And you just, I remember flinching, literally physically flinching when my agent asked me, would I like to do something or would I like to speak to somebody? And then realising that something had to start changing. And so I worked a bit harder on, I became much more aware of having to take some control and push back on some of the demands.
Do you think that was because that at the beginning of the success, when someone says to you, oh, do 4 weeks in America, then do a week in Sweden, then do 2 weeks in Germany, you're so kind of grateful that you just do everything that's asked of you. You aren't quite successful enough to go,
no, I'd spent 10 years feeling faintly apologetic to my publishers. I'm really sorry I never quite achieved the sales. I'm really sorry that this book didn't do as well as everybody hoped. You know, you just feel personally responsible. I don't know, I did. I think writers divide quite cleanly into those who feel very entitled and actually are furious with the publishers for not selling enough books. I was the opposite. I would be like, it's my fault. And I think that comes from journalism as well, which is the first thing you're told is, if the reader doesn't read beyond the first paragraph, that's your fault.
One of the things I was going to ask you was, how did you decide that you were going to write the screenplay? Because so many, it's like a received wisdom that, oh, take the money and let someone else write the screenplay. That's what all authors are told. I can understand wanting to, but it felt like a real kind of leap of faith and actually an act of extreme confidence to go, no, I'm going to write this. These are my people. I'm going to write it.
I don't know now, honestly, what gave me the confidence to do it. I think, as you said, I felt very passionately that they were my people. Also, I went into that negotiation fully prepared to hand it over. I'd never considered writing a screenplay, but then the producer asked me if I would consider it. And I am one of those people who tends to say yes before I can think of all the reasons to say no. And it was a tough process. I mean, it was a really tough process. And the script went out of my hands twice and came back to me. And I had to fight for a lot of the things in it. I mean, the one thing I will say is that I was lucky to work with a woman director, Thea Sharrock, who we were pretty much on the same page with a lot of it. So once it was just me and her, we were really quite good at working together. We understand each other very well. In fact, we've worked together since. But it was a very new world, and I don't know. I was lucky to have good friends who helped me through the process. I was able to send a couple of drafts off to two people that I know, and they would give me notes on them and tell me where I was going wrong. And it is a very different process, and you have to learn to think visually. You have to learn to think what the camera is doing at all times, which is not how I would normally write. But also, I loved it. I got to learn. I mean, that was the other exciting thing. You don't expect to be learning new skills in your 40s necessarily. And it was the steepest of learning curves, and that was exciting. And I'd written 9 books by then. Probably I'd written 10 because I'd already written Girl You Left Behind. So you become conscious that a lot of your writing process in terms of books anyway is based on tried and tested things that you've learned. And of course, everyone is different, but you know you can do it. And I didn't know I could do this. I just didn't want anybody else to do it. That was the problem, that it was such a finely balanced thing in terms of the comedy, the tragedy, the social issues, the romance, all that stuff. And the ending. And so I did want some control. And in fact, I'm not always control freak. The Giver of Stars, my latest book, I've handed over to somebody else to write, albeit somebody I trust very much. It's not that I need my fingers all over everything. I just, for that one, I knew I needed somebody else to do it. I needed to do it.
Since you mentioned Giver of Stars, your newest one, and it's quite different, isn't it? And I think, I was thinking on the way here, how the power that the success of Me Before You gave you. Because for anybody who doesn't know, the way publishing tends to work is it's like, oh, you wrote that, it was really successful, write another one, and another one. And we'll package them similarly, and the reader will know what they're getting. Mm-hmm. And from a reader's point of view, that's fair, because if you liked one Jojo Moyes, you want to know that you're going to like the next one. But Giver of Stars is, I think it's like next level. I love it. My mum loves it. Everyone I know who's read it loves it. but it's really different.
Yeah, it's. I should say, if people haven't read it, it's a very niche subject. It's about bunch of horseback librarians in rural Kentucky in the 1930s. And I have to say, when I suggested it to various publishing people, they gave me the same look that they'd given me when I said I wanted to write a book about a man in a wheelchair who didn't want to live anymore. confidence comes with age and experience, and I knew that I could make this book work, but I had to do it in a very different voice because it's a very different book. And so I had to go to Kentucky. I had to spend time with those people, absorb the language, absorb the local area. But again, that was fun because I was getting to do something completely different. I don't want to retread the same ground. I think that, you know, I don't want my brain to atrophy. I don't want my readers to get bored. God, my readers, I've never said that phrase before. How terrifying. I'd rather take a risk and get it wrong than just stick to a safe route and get it right. And I feel like the older I get, the more you're expected to take the safe route, the more I actually bridle against it.
Do you think you've got braver as you've got older?
Without a doubt. Oh, my God, yeah. To the point of foolhardiness sometimes.
Give me an example.
I don't know, taking all my scuba diving exams and going out in kind of rough waters and places where there are sharks, or driving a 7.5-ton lorry. I don't know, just things that...
Were they bucket list things?
No, I used to be too afraid to make a phone call when I was in my late teens and early 20s. And one of the reasons I went into journalism was because it made me have to use a phone back in the days when we used to use telephones. Mm-hmm. And I think I have this slightly obstinate streak. If I'm really frightened of something, I'm not going to turn away from it. I'll push my way into it because I don't know why I do it. It's a kind of compulsive urge not to be beaten by things, I guess.
I mean, I definitely think that I've got braver too, not in the same way. Probably more emotionally braver, actually. I think...
What, in terms of being able to say what you feel?
Yeah, probably. I think the only way to put it is that I was probably quite cowardly, mm-hmm. emotionally, and I'm like, can't bear a confrontation to the detriment of mm-hmm. of all kinds of things. And I think that definitely these last two or three years, those things have started to change. Mm-hmm. Not in a, I hope, not in an offensive way, but in a, you know, who do you think you're protecting, I suppose, kind of way. Are you protecting yourself? Do you think you're protecting them? Actually, none of those things, probably.
I just think, I don't know, I sometimes used to think I had quite a masculine way of approaching these things, which is I'd rather actually have the confrontation, get it out the way, and then move on. And I frequently then forget that I even had the confrontation because I don't like bearing grudge. There are very few people in this world who I've ever borne a grudge against because I'm blessed with a fairly short memory for, you know, unless somebody has really done me a wrong, I just can't be bothered to hold that thought. I'd rather just keep moving forward. If you're the product of a kind of middle class or low upper working class background, you're encouraged from childhood to always be thinking about progression. So it's like, I'll do my O levels back when they were O levels so that I can do my A levels. I'll do my A levels so that I can go to university. I'll go to university so that I can get a good job. I'll get a good job so that I can put down a down payment on a house. I'll get a nice house and then I can have a family. I'll have a nice family. And it's always the next thing. It's always about the next thing. And I realised last year that my workaholism had got kind of quite out of control. I've always had elements of it, and I had 3 days holiday last year in the toughest year of my life, and I realized that I was starting to kind of come apart at the seams. But it also made me realize, what am I doing it for? What's my next step? If I'm not enjoying this now, what is the point? I mean, I love the work, I love the process. I don't necessarily love all the stuff that goes with it, and the obligations and the promotion and the, you know, travel and all the rest of it.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
We were talking before about how women's stories are written and how, to a certain extent, our stories are like mapped out, women's much more than men, in terms of, you know, you're supposed to meet the guy, get the house, mm-hmm. have the baby, and then, bam, menopause hits. But then it's like nothing, because the story for women is stops being written then.
I mean, I have written older women. Yes, often. And one of my favourite characters is a minor character called Kathleen in Silver Bay, who is a 72-year-old woman who was once known for catching the biggest shark that New South Wales had ever seen. And in the book, she has a kind of will-she-won't-she romance with another man. She helps rescue her granddaughter. She, you know, she's fierce and she's takes no prisoners, and I just love that kind of woman, I guess, who doesn't let age wither her. And I suppose if I have a model for getting older, it's those sorts of women, which is why shouldn't I be striding out there in my inappropriate young person's shoes and my, you know, the clothes that I want. And I refuse to have people define who I am, and I celebrate those stories.
Lots of people I've spoken to have said that they've really felt like in their 40s, late 40s particularly, it's like you come to the fore a bit in your life and you stop. Depends how old your kids are, if you've got kids and all of that, but it stops being about other people in quite the same way.
Yeah, you know, in my own case, it was definitely about my children getting older. I mean, someone very wise once said to me, if you have children, you can only ever do one thing well. And I decided that was going to be work. And so for, I don't know, 20 years, my twin focuses have really been work and children. If I wasn't doing one, I was doing the other. And so I've always been quite good at maintaining friendships, but it was probably at a distance. It wasn't, I never saw friends on a weekly basis. I might speak to them on a weekly basis, but I didn't have the time to go and see them. And also I lived in a very rural location. I have done for 20 years, and it's literally, we've got further and further out until, you know, we're kind of survivalists now.
Yeah.
But the last couple of years I've spent two nights a week in London, and that's enabled me to see a lot more of my girlfriends. And I think there's a lot of things. I think, yeah, it's the energy that comes with your children not needing you to be quite so visibly present in their lives because they have their own things going on. It's to do with hormones. I remember, I don't know if I should name her, but a journalist who I admire very much telling me a story about how you knew the menopause was starting to come because before then your teenage or adult kids would come into the room and go, oh, Mom, I can't find my keys. Do you know where they are? And you'd get up and you'd start moving cushions and, well, where did you leave them? Blah, blah, blah. And then she said she knew that her hormones, her nurturing hormones, were leeching away when they did the same thing, walked in, and she just went, sat there and went, well, I don't bloody know. Find your own keys.
Yeah, like, yeah.
I'm bored. Yeah. I'm bored of finding everybody else's keys. And so I think there's a bit of that. You know, there are certain hormonal changes. I mean, I don't know if it's in me or not. I don't know because I haven't quite reached that point yet. But also it's just, yeah, it's about a regrouping of energy. And also there's an acknowledgement of among women of my age that We're not in competition with each other. We might have been a bit in our 30s or even early 40s. We're not now. Everybody's been through some crap. Everybody's had to endure something. I don't know anybody who gets away without some kind of sniper's bullet in their life. And so I think we tend to be more compassionate at this age. And also we've weeded out those people who are toxic. I mean, if you look at kind of message threads of 20-somethings and early 30-somethings, they're full of anxiety about toxic friendships and who should, am I being unreasonable to expect that my friend would do this? By this age, like, who cares? Like, I haven't got time for anybody who isn't going to just be a reasonable person around me. And I have such admiration for so many people who, you know, it's the drains and radiators thing. You either, you surround yourself with people who radiate warmth, or you just come away feeling a bit crap and drained. And actually, I'm really lucky. I'm surrounded by some just amazing women and men, but women mostly. And it's quite a nurturing relationship as well. I mean, you know, this Christmas was one that I found very hard, and a lot of women I know found hard. And there were periods where I would be making 3 calls a day at least, checking up on other women who were going through tough times, and then they would come back. And the kind of love that you feel when people just bother to check in on you is kind of an extraordinary thing.
Which almost is something that you probably haven't experienced since you were a teenager.
No.
Or certainly like early 20s. Mm.
And I've always been a sort of fiercely independent person as well. So I think, even though I've always had, you know, a best friend or two, I didn't expect people to look out for me. And then, you know, with age and you get a bit battered, things happen. And the people closest to you, if you're lucky, they step up. And it has moved me to tears sometimes, the little acts of kindness from people who you wouldn't even expect to remember that you were going through something. So although last year was a tough one, the thing that I felt very strongly that I would take from it is the kindness of my friends and the kind of joy that I feel. And new friends as well. I didn't expect to make new friends in my 50th year, but I have. And they've been amazing. And I think it's because also at this age you get a lot better at picking. And I make fairly instant decisions, which is, do I like this person? I think I do. Do I want them in my life? Yes, and I'm going to make an effort to keep them in my life.
Would it be fair to say maybe you're making decisions for the right reasons rather than, oh, I need to be friends with that person because everybody else is?
Oh, I've never done that. In fact, I've gone the opposite way, sometimes to my cost. I think I could have networked better in my young years. I never was comfortable with that. I find it easier to network now, because I feel like I'm not an imposter anymore. I feel like the body of work has given me a right to be there, but it's taken me 10 years minimum to feel like that.
If you had imposter syndrome, there would be no hope for any of us, frankly. When do you think that went? Can you pinpoint a moment, or did it just
not that long ago? Maybe 2 years ago? I'm not sure I'd even call it imposter syndrome. I just didn't feel like I was on that level. And then I suppose going on tour, and suddenly you get that's when you get feedback, because most of your life as a writer is spent in a room by yourself, and you don't want to look at social media because that's a really distorted view of what anybody thinks or feels. But then especially when I go to, I don't know, like the States or Germany or Brazil, and you suddenly have these incredibly enthusiastic readers who are telling you what things that you wrote meant to them in their own lives. And that's an extraordinary thing to have happen. And so I suppose it's the readers that made me feel validated. And if I'm really honest, the numbers of books I've sold, because...
How many books have you sold?
About 38 million. Yeah. But yeah, that, again, that's... I didn't really pay much attention till 2 or 3 years ago, and then suddenly the numbers became too big to ignore.
Yeah, huge.
And then you, I mean, all of this has been quite a, I'm somebody who likes the process. I'm not necessarily someone who looks outwards. And so when people say, oh, are you really pleased? Are you in the charts? I go, I don't know. Because for the most part, to me, that's the road to madness. Because you're always going to do worse than somebody. You're always going to do better than somebody. It's like, you know, relying on good looks. You're never going to be the most beautiful person in the room. So I'd always rather be focused on the work rather than congratulating myself on something that I've done. But I suppose in terms of feeling like I'd earned a place at the table, 38 million did it for me.
I want to talk a little bit about menopause, because when we met on the street, you were carrying a new duvet, which I've got to say was a 10.5 tug. That's too hot.
I know.
I'm telling you now, that is much too hot. So the sweats have just come for you, yeah?
Yeah, no, I do get very, very hot at night, and it's deeply unpleasant. And so, yes, I thought I'd just nip into John Lewis while I was getting something else today and come out with a duvet. But I've realised as soon as I saw you that I've got the wrong one, so I'm no doubt destined to sweat a bit more. I think I'm fairly early in the whole process because everything else is still going on. In fact, it's a really attractive mix of, you know, periods, teenage acne, menopausal sweats, all of it all at once, as with everything.
Night sweats, chest acne, can I try saying that first? It's
like, yeah, that was attractive. Yeah. And especially because I run as well. And if you are overheating, and I wear one of those kind of amazing Lululemon bras to run in that are like body armor, but the downside of it is everything gets squished together and very hot and
really sweaty.
I ended up running into my editor at the end of a run, and she said, "Oh, have a coffee." And I realized I can't do that because, like, my body just needs a cold shower straight after now. I just need to cool down. I just spend half my life at the wrong temperature.
Yeah. Did you feel like you were remotely aware of menopause, really?
No, I think it was until a couple of years ago, I think it was a rather depressing word. I probably associated it with redundancy and, you know, a thickening of the waist and a greying of the hair and a kind of crepiness. And that might be my own preconceptions. But I think as a 50-year-old woman, I'm from a generation where our mothers or our mothers' mothers wouldn't expect to be seen as attractive beyond their 40s, if that. You were considered to be a very mature person. And now, you know, I find there's a whole bunch of us who are still wearing inappropriate clothing
and plan to continue.
Yeah, the more I get, I don't know, those horrible articles going, what not to wear in your 40s? I give them a stiff finger and immediately go the other way. I bought a pair of leather jeans last year, which I have worn pretty much twice a week since and enjoyed very much.
Now, someone said to me the other day that I actually look more, in terms of the way I dress, I dress more like myself when I was 20 than I have for the last 30 years.
It's funny. I think I definitely wear my student wardrobe. I mean, I'm sitting here, I'm in clumpy black boots, black jeans and a black sweater. I mean, I this was pretty much me in 1991. Yeah.
We're, as usual, quite similarly dressed. Yeah. I'm also wearing clumpy boots, black jeans, but I've got an unironed khaki shirt on. Mm. Did your mum ever talk to you about menopause? Did you remember your mum having it? Or
I moved out when I was very young, so I don't remember it, other than I know my mum got through hers pretty easily and found it quite liberating, so that was quite reassuring to hear. I guess you don't think about it, because I suppose it's like death. You kind of what I mean is, you kind of assume it's never going to happen to you, or what's the point in thinking about it?
Exactly.
And so it's never really been part of my frame of reference. I just don't think about it, and I suppose, like a lot of my life, I just think I'll deal with it when I get there. And then also a lot of it was to do with working so hard that I didn't really have a chance to think about how I felt about much, actually, because I was always busy working.
The more people I speak to who are out the other side, the more liberating it is.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to, you know, we are all still living within the frame of reference of our society that says, you know, attractive is this and women do that. But at the same time, I think there are more and more women going, hang on a minute. You know, if I want to wear my ridiculous big boots when I'm 50, 60, 70, I will. And, you know, I may not be CEO of a FTSE 100 company, but...
Whose opinion do you really care about? Do I care what Piers Morgan says in the Daily Mail? No, I don't. Do I care what some of these judgy female commentators say? No, I don't. Do I care what my peers think? Yes, I do. And frankly, even if they don't like what I'm wearing, I could care less, because it makes me happy. I've got a kind of ridiculous blue coat. It's a leather coat that's kind of really woolly. And
is that the one you were wearing when you came in?
And yeah. That coat gives me such joy. And my clumpy boots have got a big red stripe down the back. And they give me joy. Boots. And I can stomp my whole way across London and back. And you know, all these things make me happy. And if my wardrobe makes me happy, then frankly, that's all I care about. I'm not dressed up like Sue Pollard. I'm just, you know, I think I'm age appropriate, but in the style that I like. And I think I've actually got a lot more stylish in my late 40s than I was in my late 30s, when frankly, most of the time I looked like I'd been dragged through a hedge backwards because I didn't care. And I had small children. I had other stuff to think about. And now I have more time to think about how I look, and I'm quite enjoying it, actually.
What's your emotional age?
Ooh, what, in terms of where do I feel I am?
Yeah, how old do you feel?
About 31.
Oh, do you know what? If I had a tenner for everyone who said somewhere between 30 and 35, I'd
really
be a lot richer than I am now.
That's so funny. I wonder why. I think it's because your 20s are generally quite angst-ridden. You're kind of panicking and treading water and trying to get onto certain mythical rungs of ladders. And then by the time you're in your 30s, you feel like, well, I've kind of set up a path here and I might as well go with it. And you might have met the person that you're going to end up with for a while at least. I don't know. The thing I really like about this age, and especially having finally got to grips with running a bit, which I've never been particularly good at, but I've actually just stuck with it, is I really like feeling fit. Mm. You know, I'm really enjoying having muscles that I didn't have and feeling like my back doesn't hurt all the time. Mm. And, you know, really basic stuff like that. I like the fact that when I'm in London, I pretty much walk everywhere, and anything up to about 35 minutes, I won't bother to get a tube or a taxi or a bus. I'll just walk it. And I stick my earphones in and I listen to age-inappropriate music, and it makes me happy.
I think that's one of the things that's really interesting. I went through a phase of kind of waist, the estrogen went down, the waist went up, that did happen. And for a while, I did that classic thing of dressing in a sack and generally feeling a bit shitty about myself. And then I realised that, whilst I didn't really like having no waist, it wasn't really so much about that as about the backache and the not feeling as strong as you used to feel, and like groaning when you get out of bed, which is, you know, not sexy or comfortable or anything. And it was only when I started doing weights, and then I want to be a runner, but I've never managed to quite force myself through that pain barrier, that I realized it ceased to be about being thin, because I am that sad person who always wanted to be thinner. I know I fear the Twitter backlash from saying that, but it ceased to be about that. And that probably happened in the last 2 or 3 years, that I want to be stronger and healthier.
Mm.
And
I had a frozen shoulder for 18 months, which is a classic thing for women of a certain age to get. And if you believe in Chinese medicine, it's also to do with carrying the burden of, you know, family.
Really?
Yeah, that's it's quite interesting if you do, because I saw everybody to try and fix it. I saw traditional NHS, I had the steroid injections, I had acupuncture. It was so painful and so debilitating and so interesting, the change if you live with chronic pain, how it affects you, how it pulls your face down. And it, you know, I remember my best friend coming to the door and saying, you are literally hunched like an old woman, you need to straighten up. And so when that finally went, because they do usually go by themselves, I just thought, I'm never going to be in that position again. And I started boxing once I had the all clear.
Why boxing?
Because I really wanted to improve shoulder strength and core strength. And my husband bought me a punch bag. Who knows why? And I found that, you know, I was a traditionally quite weedy kid. The only thing I could do was horses, because as my mother used to put it, that's because they do all the work. But I was never athletic and hopeless at ball sports. And it turns out, to my great joy, that hitting is the one thing I'm actually quite good at. I have a lot of power.
Let's dissect that.
Yeah, I know, but it's really bizarre. And my trainer says, you know, you hit harder than a lot of the men that I train. And I have never stopped valuing being pain-free for the last sort of 3 years since I got over it. Every day I'm grateful that nothing hurts. And the thing that is really clear to me is if I keep doing the exercise and I keep running, then stuff doesn't hurt. It's really as simple as that. And I can eat all the chocolate that I like and I can have the curry on a Friday night. And if I stop doing that for a few weeks, I'm afraid it all just turns to kind of Jabba the Hutt, because that is the downside of being this age. You have to use it or lose it. But for me, strength is the absolute key thing. I don't really care what size my jeans are, but I don't want my ass to be sagging around the back of my jeans, and I want my glutes to be holding up everything else so that I don't have problems with my knees and my hip flexors. Yeah. So, sorry, that's cool. Really tedious.
No, it's not. No, it's not at all. It's really interesting.
But it's really depressing to have to acknowledge the fact that, you know, there is no quick fix. It really is. Once you get to this age, you can tell the people who exercise and that you can tell the people who don't. And it's quite interesting for me because I've been to a couple of reunions of workplaces that I used to be at. And, you know, if you haven't seen people for 20 years, that
terrifying
difference is stark. Yeah, you can really see the people who've done nothing and the people who've made a modicum of effort to just stay on top of it all.
Now, I've got a few questions that I always ask the end. Firstly, give us a book recommendation.
Oh, I'm sure everybody said this, but the standout book for me last year was Three Women by Lisa Taddeo, which
so
I think
brilliant
in terms of thought-provoking and making you examine your own responses, making you think about society, but just also treading ground that hadn't been trod before, like in the most beautifully written way. I think it is an extraordinary work and I think it will hold up as a classic.
Definitely. What one piece of advice would you give younger women?
Claim your place in the world. I think there are so many pressures on women to focus on how they look and what not to do and what not to say. I got in terrible trouble a few years ago because I wrote a jokey piece for you, I think. Criticising adult colouring books, which I do understand have a role to play for anxiety. But what for me they represented at the time was a determination to keep women within the lines. And what I want is for women to get out and use their voices and meet people and find out who they are. And you're not going to do that if you're stuck inside.
What would your superpower be?
Oh, what is my superpower? My superpower is I can tell within five scenes whether a film is directed by a man or a woman.
What are the giveaways?
It's what's through the male gaze. I mean, this started with a film with Denzel Washington where he's a pilot who wakes up hungover in a hotel room and ends up saving a plane. But, you know, it's a kind of should he or shouldn't he, you know, it's who's the good guy in this. But this film opens with him waking up in a hotel room and this astonishing woman who looks, you know, just absolutely gorgeous, climbs out of bed, stark naked, kind of parades backwards and forwards in front of the camera with her tits, you know, stuck out, bends over, you know, straight-legged to pick up her panties, because, of course, they would be panties. And I just looked at this thing and I went, no, this is a male director. If that was a woman directing, that woman would have woken up, given Denzel a shove and gone, oh, mate, make us a coffee, please.
Yeah.
My head's flipping killing me, you know, and, oh, my God, what did you do to me last night?
Yeah.
What she wouldn't have done is breasted boobily across the set, backwards and forwards, you know. And it was such a clear example, and sure enough, it was directed by a man.
Yeah,
and so
sure,
it's become my kind of go-to game.
It's
now
your party trick.
It's my party trick.
I'm
definitely
going to remember that. Who would your old bird role model be?
So many. Oh, God. I mean, Jane Goodall for goodness, Joan Didion for writing, Iris Apfel for not giving a shit what anybody thinks of what you wear and just loving how you look in a kind of joyful, pleasurable way. Oh, God. Catherine Hepburn for not giving a shit. Jane Fonda for just milking it till late on and getting arrested every week for causes she believes in. Again, not giving a shit what society thinks about her. There's so many.
Which brings me to the last question.
Mm.
How many fucks do you give?
Oh, God, increasingly few. Like a tiny one at best. Really, there's very few fucks left on my shelf. I'm too old, I'm too tired. I spend half my life walking around muttering, Just do your fucking job. That's all I'm asking.
That's absolutely brilliant. Thank you, Jojo Moyes.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I'd love to hear your feedback. You can reach me on Twitter at Sam Baker and Instagram at The Other Sam Baker using the hashtag The Shift. You can hear a new episode of The Shift each week on Acast, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you hear, please do rate and subscribe because it really does help other people find us.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.